Dr. Sarah Berry. Welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.
Sarah, you've worked a lot in the area of personalized nutrition. What's been the most surprising findings that you found about how individuals can affect their responses to various foods?
So I think having spent 25 years in nutrition research, where I always focused on what we call the average response, so looking at how a group of individuals respond to one kind of diet versus another kind of diet, I think over the last 6 years, suddenly delving into how individuals respond differently has been a real eye-opener in terms of the size of the difference. I had never really considered just how huge the difference is between how I might respond to a food versus how you might respond to a food. And depending on what outcome we're looking at, you can see like a 20-fold difference in how you might respond from some particular health measure to a food versus how I might respond.
It's really interesting because I've long looked at these peer-reviewed studies on food, and I'd look at it and I'd say, you know, a group of 200 people, you know, went through this protocol and they responded in this way. And I always find myself walking away from it going, I don't really care how the 200 people responded. I care how I respond to this same protocol.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for population-based guidance, then the average response or the mean response is really valuable. So for population-based guidance saying, okay, on average, should we be giving people more fiber? Should we be reducing people's saturated fat intake? Then those kind of studies looking at the average, where everyone responds generally in the same direction. For example, saturated fat is bad for everyone. Fiber is good for everyone. Then looking at the average response is really valuable. But food is so much more nuanced than all of these nutrients that are in it. We know that food has thousands of chemicals, and these thousands of chemicals are packaged within a very complex food structure, which we call food matrix. And if we combine that complexity of food together with the complexity of us, that's why we respond so, so differently in different directions. And this is where it's really important, like you say, not to think about how everyone else responds or how the average person responds, but how you as an individual respond.
Have you looked at studies about the non-biological response of food? Like by that, I mean, food is such a ritualistic thing for us. And it has been since, you know, we were cavemen, that we celebrated by sitting around a fire and cooking meat together. And there's still something about that. Most of us get together at the holidays, or if you're in the States around Thanksgiving, the family all comes together. So food has a purpose that's greater than just the chemical reactions that take place when we eat it. Has that been studied much?
So when I think about our health responses to food, or when I think about how we should personalize advice around food, I think about it across four different areas. So I think about it in terms of what we eat. And by what we eat, I think beyond simple nutrients like fat, protein, fiber, carbohydrate, but, you know, all of the thousands of nutrients in the matrix. I think about who we are. And by who we are, I mean our biology. So whether it be our gut microbiome or our genetics or our age or our sex. I think about how we eat. And by how we eat, I mean like what time of day we're eating, the meal ordering. Are we having carbohydrates in the morning or the afternoon? How long have we fasted overnight? When have we done exercise? What was the intensity, duration, and timing of that exercise compared to our meal? And then I think about why. Why do we make those dietary choices? Is it cultural? Is it simply because we're hungry and we like the food? Is it emotional? And I think an area that hasn't been researched enough, but is an area I'm really excited by, is the how we eat. And that's really personalized as well. So the who you are, like your biology that I mentioned, shapes a lot of how you respond to food, but the how you eat is another huge area of personalization that we're really starting to discover more and more, particularly the research that I'm doing at Zoe around things like eating rate, time-restricted eating, timing of eating, physical activity, etc., sleep as well.
You mentioned meal ordering. Is this a case of like, you know, we have chairs around the table in Titanic and no matter what order we put these in, it's essentially going to be the same outcome. But meal ordering is this idea that you can arrange these chairs differently and we get a different outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a perfect example of the complexity of what shapes our responses to food, because there's so many thousands of different variables each day that are going to partly shape how you respond to that food. And so when we talk about meal ordering, we can look at it in two different ways. One is simply, how does what you have for breakfast impact your response to your lunch meal? And how does the order of the food that you eat within that same kind of sitting impact your response? So if we think about circulating blood glucose, which is a measure of blood sugar, so when you have any foods containing carbohydrates, you have an increase in circulating blood glucose. And I'm sure many of the cyclists listening here will be well aware about the importance of maintaining a certain level of circulating blood glucose. And what happens is when you eat a carbohydrate-rich meal, you have an increase in blood glucose that peaks around 15 minutes, returns to baseline around 30 to 45 minutes after eating that carbohydrate. Now, if that peak is excessive, like really, really high, and if you also have what we call a blood sugar crash, so a dip, we know that the excessive peak, if it's repeated time and time again, is bad for the health. So we know it increases inflammation, it increases type 2 diabetes risk, it increases your chance of getting obesity and cardiovascular disease. We also know that the dip is problematic in terms of alertness, energy, and also calorie intake at subsequent meals. So something that we focus a lot of our research on is looking at how we can modify the shape of that glucose curve after you consume carbohydrates. So how you can prevent the really big peaks that are harmful to health, or prevent the big dips that we know are unfavorable in terms of those other factors about how you feel. And this really nicely can illustrate as well the importance of meal ordering. So for example, we've conducted a study at Zoe where everyone had in random order different breakfasts. So we had 50 people who over a couple of week period in random order had each morning after fasting overnight a different kind of carbohydrate-rich breakfast, but everyone had exactly the same lunch meal. Now, their blood glucose response after their lunch meal was partly shaped by what they had for breakfast. And so even though they're having exactly the same lunch meal, what we also see within a meal, and this is quite a new area of research, that the order in which you eat your foods within a meal can also impact your blood glucose response.
Interesting.
And so we know that fiber in a meal, fat in a meal, and protein in a meal delays your rate of gastric emptying. So it delays the rate at which your stomach empties, and therefore the rate at which the blood glucose will appear in your bloodstream. So if for health reasons you want to reduce that sudden peak in glucose, then it's really good to have before your carbohydrates or with your carbohydrates, fat, protein, or fiber. So you could have something, if you're having, let's say you're having a starter, or you're having a kind of little snack before your main meal, if you had something that contained fat, protein, or fiber, it would delay the rate at which your stomach emptied that glucose into your bloodstream. Now, I know that it's different in sports nutrition, that sometimes you want that rapid increase in blood glucose, in which case that's why you're best to have just something that contains glucose or sugar, so you're not delaying the rate at which it empties, so that you can get that rapid rise into your bloodstream.
I think people feel so overwhelmed about nutrition, Sarah, and it's because it's so complex. And I spoke to Dr. Dan Plews on the podcast. He's an expert in heart rate variability, and he said one of the challenges with heart rate variability is there's a lot of academic research on heart rate variability, and it's an extremely complex topic. Mm. But then what you're trying to do is take something that is, in its essence, very, very complex, and to try and simplify it for a mass audience. So you're trying to take a measurement of heart rate variability and bring it into a Whoop or an Oura Ring,
yeah,
and simplify it as one number to say, okay, I feel good today, I feel bad today, when the reality of it is heart rate variability is a lot more complex than just looking at a number and saying I feel good, I feel bad, as Whoop or Oura would try and have us believe. Nutrition kind of feels the same to me, that the mass media wants to simplify it. If you do X, you're going to be healthy, when it is a very nuanced and multifaceted area of discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, everyone wants a silver bullet. Everyone wants a quick fix. And, you know, nutrition, health, exercise, it's all the same. It's so nuanced. And all of these different metrics, like you say, you know, that I have an Oura Ring myself, and I actually don't look at the combined scores. Like, I think it gives a readiness score. I wouldn't look at that. Now, that's partly because I'm a scientist and I know that it's oversimplifying it. And actually, for me, it's, I believe it's quite meaningless. The problem is that people do need simple messaging, but also people want quick fixes when it comes to nutrition. And so this is why you see this rapid growth that we're having recently in things like these green powders, you know, the juices that people are having. And they're like, oh, well, you know, I can eat what I want. This is in a food landscape where 60% of our energy is coming from ultra-processed food that we know is bad for us. But hey, that's fine. I'll just add in one of these green powders or shakes and it offsets it. Unfortunately, it's not that simple. And, you know, I have a boring message because there isn't a silver bullet. It's not that simple. Food is complicated. How we respond is complicated. Now, we can make it simple by following some very simple principles in terms of reducing how much ultra-processed food we have, in terms of listening to our hunger signals, trying to eat a plant diversity. So trying to eat more plant-based foods in their original structure, unprocessed, but a diversity of different plants, trying to increase our fiber intake, trying to add fermented food in as well. So there's lots of simple strategies we can incorporate, but within these, it's nuanced. And, you know, perfect example, if I can give you an example of sometimes why it can be so confusing is dairy. Now, for years and years, people have been told you've got high cholesterol, reduce your dairy intake, don't have loads of cheese. Dairy's got loads of saturated fat in, saturated fat's bad for us. But what we know is that actually it's not that simple. So within the category of dairy, you've got hundreds of different products, different cheeses, different yogurts, butter, milk, etc. What we know is that if you ferment dairy, which is what happens with cheese and which is what happens with yogurt, that it changes the structure. So whilst it still has loads of saturated fat in it, the process of fermentation that changes the structure actually prevents the normal increase in cholesterol that you would see from having the unfermented butter or milk, for example. And so therefore, a headline saying reduce your dairy if you've got high cholesterol actually is oversimplified, because it's fine to have cheese. It's fine to have unsweetened yogurt if you have, because it won't increase your cholesterol intake, your cholesterol levels.
But I know in sports, I see people, and I call it major and the minor things, where they have too much focus on stuff that is marginal in the benefit for them, and not enough focus on the unglamorous reality of you need to sweat and you need to train quite a lot to get any adaptation. And I wonder, is the same true of nutrition? Preparing for this podcast, I sat in the cafe across the road and I just observed people going past, and anecdotally, like I would say 70 to 80% of people that come into the cafe are overweight. And I wonder, is there like a Maslow hierarchy of needs equivalent with nutrition, where if we're faced with this obesity epidemic, where you're talking to people about fermenting cheeses, you know, is the reality they need to be looking at macro control and they need to be looking at, you know, getting a caloric neutrality or deficit each day and maybe forgetting about the fermented cheeses? Does that type of thinking exist within the nutritional sphere?
Yeah, certainly amongst nutritional scientists like myself, we are always conscious of what we call the size impact. So in the same way that you talk about the major and the minor, we talk about what is the size impact of making that change in terms of a given health outcome. Now, some of the areas that are heavily promoted now, particularly amongst influencers, and are kind of seen as, you know, sexy changes to your diet, actually have quite a small size impact. Now, for some people, even starting small, if it helps them in terms of it motivates them, they're more likely to adhere to the bigger things that are often the more boring things, then great, let's do that. But we would always try and start with what has the biggest size impact on your health. So if we're talking about obesity, for example, what's going to have the biggest size impact to reduce levels of obesity? Obesity is multifactorial. And so it is challenging because it's going to be different for every individual. So for some people, they might be overweight because of emotional reasons that are causing them to eat excess calories. some people might be overweight because they're having a diet that's exclusively ultra-processed food that causes you to eat faster, eat more calories, etc. There's so many different reasons to why people might be overweight or have high cholesterol or have type 2 diabetes. So the major factor will differ from one individual to the other. But at the heart of, or kind of the foundation of nutrition, I think that, you know, what we're all agreed is that everyone's eating too much heavily processed, unhealthy food. And this causes us to overeat. So we know from research that if you eat heavily processed or ultra-processed food compared to nutritionally matched food, but that just hasn't been through all these levels of process, you on average consume 500 calories more per day. You eat your food.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's huge. There was a randomized controlled trial, so a clinical trial actually fed one group of individuals for a couple of weeks an ultra-processed food diet, and then another group of individuals the nutritionally matched unprocessed diet. So it had the same fat, protein, fiber, carbohydrate. And what they found is those that were fed the ultra-processed food, they ate the food 50% more quickly. So they hadn't had time for the fullness signals to say, hey, stop, you know, you don't need to eat anymore. They ate 500 calories more each day. And within just a couple of weeks, they started to put weight on, as well as it impact their metabolic health.
Well, you see it all the time when food's been stripped of fiber. Like, you know, a classic example is oranges versus orange juice.
Yeah.
To try and drink 500 calories of orange juice, super easy to drink 500 calories of orange juice. Try sit there and eat 500 calories of oranges. Like, there's a lot of chewing at 500 calories of oranges.
Yeah, and I think that's a really lovely example of a couple of things that are going on there. One, you're taking out one of the really healthy nutrients from orange juice. So you're taking out the fiber. And so what that means is, therefore, the fiber that would normally delay the rate at which your stomach empties the sugar from the orange juice into your stomach is no longer there. So you're having this rapid surge of blood glucose. But what's also happening is, because you're changing the texture of the food, you're changing the speed at which you can eat it as well. And so by changing that texture, it means, like you said, you can gulp that orange juice down in seconds, but it would take you a certain amount of time to eat them as whole oranges, which firstly would also delay the rate at which the glucose is appearing in your blood. But secondly, it would allow the fullness signals that come from your lower intestine to actually get to your brain to say, hey, come on, Sarah, you've had enough. You don't need to eat your 20th orange now.
Is it frustrating for someone in an academic quarter who's typically underfunded compared to these big corporations to watch false marketing messages being proliferated to the public, like orange juice is a healthy breakfast?
I think what I find more frustrating is that, in an effort to oversimplify messaging, I think we're ultimately doing harm to the general public. I think that's what's most frustrating. So, for example, if we think about fiber, fiber is good for us for a couple of reasons. One is because it actually is the cell wall of plants. So it has a really important structural role. And one of the reasons it's really good for us is because of this structural role it has. Now, if you add fiber into a food, so let's say you were to take the fiber away from, for example, the orange. So if we use that as an example, so you have your orange juice, but you add the fiber back in. You are then having fiber, which will have some benefit, but you've taken away its really important structural role, which actually is one of the reasons why fiber is so good for us. Now, I can make a claim saying, okay, it's high in fiber, but actually it's not really high in what I would call particularly effective fiber, because it's not doing what it was meant to do in its original matrix, in its original structure. But how do I communicate that? How do I say on the label, oh, well, you know, you're having the fiber back in, but it's not doing the matrix bits, blah, blah, blah. You know, no one's going to want to read that. I mean, I'm bored saying it. And so this is the problem, that it's so nuanced with food. And that's why, like, for example, I gave the example of the saturated fat and the dairy, is we are taught to look at simple messages. Saturated fat's bad for you. Look at the back of perfect labeling. Look at butter. Look at cheese. Same saturated fat. My gosh, they must both be bad for me. But it's not that simple. And I think that, yes, there is a lot of marketing around these heavily processed food. They are designed to be tasty. They are designed to leave us wanting more. And I think that we live in a current food landscape that is incredibly harmful, and that it makes eating unhealthy food far easier than eating healthy food. And I think it's the entire food landscape that I think we need to revisit. And it has to start with some of these big companies as well, rethinking how they're messaging food as well.
You touched on something when you were talking about obesity, that it's so multifactorial, that there's an emotional element to it. But I think we haven't helped ourselves as healthcare professionals across the board, because everything has been so siloed. You've had therapists dealing with emotional well-being, you know, siloed off from physical therapists, siloed off from dietitians, siloed off from physiotherapists, each of them operating in a vacuum, when the reality is they're also interconnected. This was really brought home to me when I started using a continuous glucose monitor. Super Sapiens was the brand. So I'd weigh out my oats for breakfast in the morning. So I'd, you know, go to bed at night, get up in the morning, have my weighed portion of oats. I'd eat them, and then I'd observe the effect on my blood sugar levels after eating those oats. I'd wake up the next morning, having slept 8 hours, exact same as the night before, have the exact same portion of oats, and I'd observe a totally different effect on my blood sugar. And that's when I started digging in and saying, okay, how much does sleep affect my nutrition? It turns out it affected a massive amount, an amount that's almost made the use of the continuous glucose monitor for that purpose for me a little bit redundant, because now I had to play this role of, you know, part-time bro scientist, where I had to try and figure this out myself, because I hadn't got access to professionals to explain this to me. But talk to me a little bit about how sleep affects the role of, how sleep affects food and that interaction.
Yeah, so I think sleep is a great example of the how we eat that I mentioned at the beginning, and how we can impact how we respond to food. So if we look at sleep in relation to circulating blood glucose, as you used as an example, what we know from our own research that we published a couple of years ago is that within an individual, if you have a good night's sleep, and you have exactly the same breakfast compared to if you have a bad night's sleep and have exactly the same breakfast, you will have a lower blood glucose response. So you'll have a more blunted blood glucose peak that will stay sustained at a low level for a bit longer, and then you are less likely to have this kind of crash that we talk about as well, 2 to 4 hours after the meal. If you have a bad night's sleep, even if everything else is the same, like you're controlling what physical activity you've done, etc., then, and you have exactly the same breakfast, then you have a higher blood sugar peak that may also predispose you to having this crash. There's also other things that are going on when you haven't slept well. So when you haven't slept well as well, the reward centers in your brain are heightened. And so they need a quick fix. They need kind of that dopamine hit to satisfy these reward centers. So it leaves you craving for these quick fixes. So what's happening is you'll crave for something like a more, you know, refined carbohydrate style breakfast. You're less likely to want a particularly healthy, balanced breakfast. So you're kind of getting a double hit going on, that firstly your brain's saying, hey, I need a quick fix, go and give me that, you know, pastry, etc. And then when you're having that pastry, because you've had a bad night's sleep, you're also having a worse blood glucose response. Then what happens is you start on this roller coaster, and you start on this roller coaster of big peaks and potentially big dips in glucose. And this is an area that we've been doing a lot of work on, which is around the dips in glucose that can happen 2 to 4 hours after having carbohydrate-rich meals. And it's something that actually very few people have looked at, and we've got some really interesting data around that as well.
Yeah, I've definitely observed that as well. I hate to tag foods as good and bad, because I think when you do that, you start to bring in this almost morality around eating it. Because, you know, even a quote unquote bad food, I think eaten at the right time, like during exercise, now it becomes, you know, quite a good fuel. Yeah. But I've anecdotally observed when I sleep poorly, I wake up the next morning and I've less willpower to avoid the bad foods. You know, if I live very close to a shop, and I'll often go up and I'll pick milk and eggs and stuff up for breakfast. but they have a beautiful French bakery and the smells waft up. And 99 times out of 100, I'm like, okay, I know I don't need a pan de raisin right now with my coffee. But if I've had a bad night's sleep, I am quite susceptible to a pan de raisin.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we should be quite gentle on ourselves in that our brain is directing us to that. And, you know, this adage that, oh, it's all about willpower. Yes, there's an element of willpower. But so what, having that, you know, pan au chocolat or that croissant once in a while, it's not going to do you any harm. So you've had a bad night's sleep, you know, for whatever reason. Go gentle on yourself and allow yourself to have it is my motto.
Today's show sponsor is Pillar. Well, we're all familiar with the importance of electrolytes and carbohydrates and their role in our race preparation, Pillar is taking a completely different route. It focuses on micronutrition, ensuring we're ready to perform even before we hit the start line. It's all about promoting a good night's sleep, facilitating effective recovery, and replenishing those crucial micronutrients so you can perform at your very, very best. I've been running my own personal little experiment over the past month, and I've been incorporating Pillar's triple magnesium supplement into my evening routine. I take it about 30 minutes before bed, and the results I've seen are absolutely remarkable. The improvement in sleep quality, about 10% I've seen. I've been tracking my sleep with my Whoop device, and the results are there in absolute black and white. I've given this to friends, they've tested it, and they've all experienced the same results. I wake up feeling refreshed, having had a deep restorative sleep, so I'm ready to attack work, training, and life the next day. But don't just take my word for it. The data from your fitness tracker will tell you the story. So if you're ready to elevate your performance and your sleep quality like me, just go ahead and give Pillar a try. Head to pillarperformance.shop and use the code ROADMAN on your local website for 15% off your first order. If you're watching this in the US, head over to thefeed.com/pillar and use the code ROADMAN for 15% off that first order as well. Now let's get back to the show. So snacking kind of has a bad rep, and yeah. I kind of want to deal with maybe snacking and intermittent fasting here in the same you know, sentence. So intermittent fasting, the typical protocol that's pushed online is this 18-hour fasting period with a 6-hour feeding period to get that cellular autophagy and all those benefits. And then snacking, I think almost in the same sentence, has been demonized. But my understanding from reading some of your work is that snacking isn't entirely bad at certain periods in the day. It's more just in that last meal of the day or, you know, post 8 o'clock that snacking becomes quite toxic to our health and longevity goals.
Yeah, so we've done quite a bit of work looking at snacking. And I think snacking is something really important because 95% of people snack. On average, we have 2.5 snacks a day if you're a snacker. And 25% of calories on average comes from snacks in the UK. That's huge. That's a quarter of our calories. And if we put that into the context of how many calories come from our evening meal, it's pretty similar. And people spend a lot of time thinking about how they can have a healthy evening meal, what they can add in, etc. But actually, our snacks that we have throughout the day account for just the same amount of energy. So if we can focus on the quality of the snacks and eating healthy snacks, we can go a really huge way to improving our health. And the research that we did tried to look at a couple of really important questions related to snacking. Does the frequency of snacking matter? Is it all about the quality or is it about the timing? And so there is this question about, oh, you shouldn't snack. We should go back to the three main meals, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, our ancestors didn't snack, although, you know, there is the hunter-gatherer from before that. So I think it's kind of varied, you know, through history. What our research shows is that having multiple snacks, or another term we use for this is multiple eating events. So eating or grazing throughout the day, as long as you're grazing on healthy food and grazing when you're hungry rather than out of habit, then our research shows that there is no detrimental effect on your health. It's if you're not listening to your hunger signals and if you're eating or grazing, snacking on unhealthy foods, that's where the problem arises. And the problem is that the majority of snacks that people eat are higher in unhealthy saturated fats, higher in salt, higher in sugar, higher in refined carbohydrates. They tend to be lower in fiber, lower in heart healthy oils, and stripped of a lot of the kind of bioactive nutrients that makes food so special. So chemicals like polyphenols that, you know, have great properties in terms of improving our health. And so we need to be mindful about the kind of snacks we're having, but I think not so much worrying about having snacks between meals. But what our research did show is that snacking late in the evening, so particularly if you snacked after 9 o'clock, and we found a huge proportion of people do snack after 9 o'clock.
Culturally, that's kind of where we've gone to, isn't it? Where people chill out in the evening and watch Netflix, and they might have, you know, an ice cream or a popcorn or crisps or something with that.
Yeah. So interestingly, we actually found that the kind of food people were snacking on after nine was more unhealthy than the kind of snacks people were having before 9 o'clock, you know, which confirms, you know, exactly what you're saying, that, you know, sitting in front of Netflix, having some crisps, a bit of chocolate, et cetera. So firstly, people are snacking on slightly less healthy snacks later in the evening. But we also know that eating, whether it's snacking or your main meal later in the evening, for most people is not the healthiest way to eat. And this is because there's a growing understanding amongst scientists of what we call your circadian rhythm, so circadian biology. And a really simple way to explain this is that every cell in our body has its own clock. And so all of the cells that are dealing with how we metabolize food have their own clock as well. And that clock is primed to work better for some things at some times of the day versus other times of the day.
And well, that makes perfect sense, because when I've traveled long haul, I felt that urge to eat breakfast or lunch at a bizarre time that was local, but it was actually my native time to be eating breakfast or lunch back home.
Yeah. So it's interesting. There's two main things that control our circadian rhythm. So it will control the clocks in all of these cells. One is the light-dark cycle. And the other is the timing that we eat our food. So what you'll find is some people that travel a lot for business, but only maybe are going for, you know, a 24-hour period or something, they can't control the light-dark cycle within reason. And so what they can control, though, is trying to maintain eating at the same time that they would have been eating back at home, so that therefore they're keeping largely their circadian clock on rhythm with their typical pattern, so that when they come back, it's less that, you know, they have less jet lag, which is an interesting thing to try. I'm going to Vancouver on Sunday, but I'm there for 4 days. I don't think I can be eating in the middle of the night.
An interesting group to study would be pilots. I have a couple of friends who are pilots, and their dietary habits, they baffle me. Like, their sleep and dietary habits are just so much of an outlier compared to the general population.
Yeah, so there's a whole area of research around shift workers for that same reason, that they're having maybe 3 or 4 days a week where they're eating in one kind of time zone, and then they're having, you know, 2 or 3 days a week where they're eating in a different time zone. And we actually know that for shift workers, there's a really high rate of cardiovascular disease, of obesity and type 2 diabetes. Now, that's in part because of the food that many shift workers eat. So it is known that many shift workers don't have as healthy a diet as non-shift workers, non-night shift workers, because of access to food at certain times of the night. But also, independent of the type of food that we're eating, because they're eating out of sync with their circadian clock, so with their body clock, we know that that's also unfavorable for their health.
There's been this kind of growing movement around longevity, how long we live.
Yeah.
And I think that is definitely welcome debate. But what I'd be a little bit more concerned of is health span. And I'd almost define that as being able to do the activities you love for as long as you can in your life. Like, we have a local group spin for cycling, and one of the guys that comes on it, one of my friends, he's 83 or 84 years old, and he's still able to ride with 20-year-olds. And I look at that as, that's goals for me. That's what I want to be able to do. I don't want to live to 90, but have to discontinue the activities I love at 60. In the research that you've seen, is there a difference between eating for lifespan to live as long as we can versus eating for health span to live as high a quality of life as possible?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And something we're very focused on, particularly at Zoe, is really, you know, thinking about healthy years, which is that health span rather than lifespan. I don't think that we can differentiate between the best diet for health span versus the best diet for lifespan. What is going to keep us healthy the longest is the kind of diet that will also keep us alive for the longest in most instances, in my opinion. It's not something I've thought about if it would be different, actually.
Yeah, no, it was just, it popped into my head. You kind of identified the spikes in blood sugar and trying to flatten those over a macro period as being one of the determinants for longevity. Is there anything else that you've come across in your research that's key to chronic disease prevention?
So we know that being overweight, you know, the kind of classic things that, you know, again, I think that people think, oh, this is boring, you know, we all know this. But, you know, what we've known for years still stands true. Being overweight reduces your healthy years or your health span. Having elevated blood cholesterol reduces your health span. Having high blood pressure significantly reduces your health span. And, you know, 60% of people have slightly elevated blood pressure and don't even know it, which is a worry. Having type 2 diabetes reduces your health span. All of these factors that I've mentioned, such as obesity, blood pressure, cholesterol, type 2 diabetes, are all underpinned by diet. They're all underpinned by mechanisms like chronic inflammation. And so I think the really good news is that at any age, we can reduce our risk of these major risk factors that reduce our health span. And it's never too late. And there's some great research that came out recently showing that if you follow what it was called a longevity diet versus the UK typical diet, even if you start following this longevity diet at the age of 60, you can still significantly improve your health. You can increase your health span as well as your lifespan. And when we talk about longevity diet, what we mean is the best of everything, you know, having the optimal fiber intake, the optimal number of fruits and vegetables, reducing your ultra processed meats, for example, reducing your refined carbohydrates. So taking all of the best and putting that together into this longevity diet at any age will improve your health.
What a catch. Roadman, you know how serious I take my goal setting, and I know how serious you take it too. So whether you're chasing fitness or lifestyle goals, and you're looking for a powerful ally to support you on this journey, look no further than Huel. Huel has become my secret weapon for when I don't have time to prepare a balanced meal. It means I get the nutrition I need without sacrificing time or taste. Plus, it stops me from reaching for the takeaway menu. I always throw a bottle of this banana into my backpack when I'm heading into the city, and it stops me eating junk convenience foods that don't support my training goals. It's handy, it's nutritious, it's 22 grams of protein. It's perfect for athletes that don't have time to cook or prepare food before a training session. It's convenient, nutritious fuel at your fingertips, ensuring you hit your daily fueling needs. Huel Ready to Drink has over 26 essential vitamins and minerals in every bottle, making sure you get 175 health benefits. Plus, it's made from amazing natural ingredients like sunflower seed, coconut, and more. And the best part, 8 mouth-watering flavors. My favorite's the banana. That's what's in my backpack at the moment. You can get Huel direct to your home by going to huel.com/roadman. That's Huel, huel.com/roadman.
How important is variety? I found myself that during periods where I'm super busy or I'm recording a lot on the podcast and I'm trying to balance my training, that I've defaulted to eating like a healthy diet and a well-balanced macro diet, but very little variety, where I'll nearly have the same breakfast every, like I'll have 2 turkey burgers, 2 eggs, 2 toast every morning. I'll have chicken, rice and veg for every dinner, and I'll have, you know, some sort of yogurt with fruit and nuts almost every lunch. But I could go like a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks where I won't have another meal outside of that.
So I think this goes back to a point you said earlier about major and minor impact. So the major impact that food is going to have on your health is by making sure you're getting enough fiber, you're reducing your overall level of ultra-processed food, you're having, you know, fruits and vegetables. Now, what we also know, overlaid onto kind of those major foundations, is that by having a diversity, you can really optimize your diet. And so whilst if you're still having adequate fiber, adequate nutrients from, you know, unprocessed plant-based foods and reducing these healthy foods, even if you're eating the same thing week on week, you can still have a reasonably healthy diet. By having that variety means you're exposing your body to these thousands of chemicals that we know exist in food. So we know that food isn't simply a case of the four macronutrients, fiber, protein, fat, carbohydrate. We know that foods contain up to about 20,000 chemicals in each food. Each of those chemicals interact with the other chemicals in that food and with other food that might be within the meal that you're having. And each of those chemicals have different properties. So if we use polyphenols, for example, and you might hear people often say, eat the rainbow. And this is because the chemicals called polyphenols, which give fruits and vegetables their pigmented colour, so the colour, whether it's the yellow, the orange, the greens, the reds, for example, each of those colours is from a different kind of polyphenol or a different chemical that has a different role in the body in improving your health. And so by eating the rainbow or having a variety, then you're maximising the types of different chemicals you're having that might act in a slightly different way than some of the other chemicals and therefore optimising your health. We also know for another reason as well it's important, which is your microbiome. And the microbiome is a really rapidly growing area of research and an area we've focused on a lot. And the microbiome is simply the trillions of bugs that are in your gut. And we have trillions of bugs that differ between each individual that actually have a party on all of the undigested food, which is mainly the fiber that reaches our gut. And this is why fiber is so important. We also know that it eats some of these polyphenols, so these different coloured parts as well of fruits and vegetables. Now, these bacteria have really wide-reaching roles in our health, many of which have beneficial effects on our health. But different bacteria, which have different impacts on our health, feed on different kinds of fibre or different kinds of plant chemicals. And so if we have that diversity, we will also be encouraging a real diverse growth of different bacteria and therefore improving different areas of our health more.
Super interesting, Sarah. Very last thing before we finish up. My girlfriend always says to me that if she's standing up eating biscuits beside the kettle as she's making tea, the calories don't count when she's standing up. Is there any truth to this?
No. It's the simple answer to that. But if she's enjoying those biscuits, then fair play. You know, something that I think we can lose sight of in a quest to be healthy is actually about the pleasure of food. And food is there to be enjoyed as well as to be healthy. You know, it's part of our culture, it's part of our society, it's part of our emotions. It should be there for joy. And I often say to people that if a food is too healthy to be enjoyed, it's just not healthy at all. And so if your girlfriend enjoys having those biscuits, whether she's standing up having, while the kettle's boiling or sitting down, then in moderation, it's fine.
Sarah, thank you very much for your time. I'm going to link up your website, podcast, YouTube channel, and all the amazing work you guys do at Zoe in the description so people can check it out. Thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.